Feral Audio.
Well, hello. It's time for another episode of Drew Drogi's Minor Revelations. How are ya? We've been running the show for a little over a year, so I thought I would just sort of give a little description about the show and what this is if you're tuning in for the first time or if you've listened to a couple and wondered why, what's happening. Minor Revelations is a show in which I bring on two guests and we talk about something that we maybe have never talked about, at least in a public forum before, as an icebreaker. And I started it because I love being on other people's podcasts, but I would feel like I was saying the same things. I was talking about the same stuff when I would get to guests on other people's shows. And I feel like a lot of people do a lot of podcasts now, and it's part of our culture. And I wanted people to kind of come on and sort of reveal something that they maybe hadn't. And it can be something really big. It can be something really tiny. But just for people who might be fans of someone's work who want to maybe go a little bit deeper. Some weeks it's super surface and really stupid. And some weeks it feels like Oprah. And I have no idea. The other thing is I have no idea what they're going to tell me before they come on the show. So it's always a lot of fun and a real ride for me as well. Okay, so this week I had something else I was going to talk about, but I feel I need to just talk about what's sort of going on in the world with all this Weinstein stuff happening and, you know, and just sort of, and all the, and this, this sort of weird backlash and sort of my sort of rant towards all of that. Obviously, we've found out that this person that everyone has hated on different levels throughout the business, but has had to tolerate, has become was actually this insanely this pig who was a predator, and not just a creep and not just an asshole or a bully, but someone who was actually using his power on countless women. And so ding dong, I'm thrilled that he's gone, and I feel like it's a huge sigh of relief. And it's banged, it is, what's the word I'm looking for? It has pushed open this closet door of so many other people coming forward and talking about, their sexual harassment or sexual violence or on whatever level. And I think it's a wonderful thing that's happening. It's horrible that it's taken this to do, but I think it's great that people are naming names. And I think and I think it's very important in this moment to just honor everybody's everything right now, because I think I've seen this just yesterday, a lot of people on Facebook, a lot of women were posting Me Too. They were just saying Me Too, Me Too, Me Too, meaning this also happened to me, obviously. And then a couple of men have come forward and said Me Too. And then a lot of people have been criticizing the men for sort of jumping on something that is targeting women. And I have mixed feelings about this, because I do feel like it is two different things. As someone who this has happened to me, and I'll talk about that in a little bit, I think we need to recognize this time for women. And I think it's very important that we see this as something that men do to women. And when they do it to men, it has different contexts. It's not okay, obviously. It's not better or worse. It's just different. And I think that we need to acknowledge that this is something that is about power. It's not about sex. It's literally about how I can use this power. You're not going to get this because of this other thing. Also, I think that women are socialized to be compliant and to not ruffle feathers and to, all these things that sort of play into these predators. Whereas a lot of men who might be the prey, it's not as big a deal to them, at least in the moment. They might a year later, 5 minutes later, whatever time later, realize this is inappropriate and terrible. But men are given a lot more tools as to handle this kind of stuff than women are. But I think it's really important not to attack any man who is sharing his story as well, because another thing that someone pointed out interestingly, that the only people who are attacking men for coming out and saying Me Too are other men. I think, not to totally generalize, but I haven't seen any women go online and say, look, you can't do this. You can't. This moment is about us. I think ultimately they see this as a sign of support for them as well. And saying, like, I'm glad, I'm sorry that you went through this, but I'm glad you understand and that you see me. And the most that I could write yesterday was, I believe you, which I had seen someone else write. And I've seen a lot of other people share that. And just, I think that's really what's important now is to just say, I hear you, I see you, I believe you. This happened. And also to assess the situation. I mean, I was 22. I had just moved to LA. I started working at Pottery Barn. Things were going really well for me, you guys. And I had a male manager at the store who sexually harassed me for the like 3-4 months that I worked there. And it was just graphic, dirty, gross stuff. And a lot of suggestive stuff. And then when I thought it was really funny at first, I thought it was cool to be flirted with, to be quite honest. And I flirted back. I thought part of it is like, well, I'm sort of learning how to be gay, and this is part of it. This is par for the course. This is an older gay guy, and this is how I guess I have to just take this. I sort of deserve this. And also, I can't really be mad about this because I'm playing along and I'm sort of enjoying it. And so, and then when it started to get uncomfortable, I would get punished. I would get in a lot of trouble. I would be yelled at about, not arranging candles properly or not dusting a shelf or arranging the wonderful Pottery Barn soundtrack CDs that they had, on display a new one every month. And so I realized that like, oh, if I don't play along with this guy, I would be immediately in trouble. And so there was a power play going on. And I hated working at Pottery Barn for a million reasons. And this was only one of them. It never got to a point where there was a threat of any sort of physical violence. He never cornered me. It was only verbal, but it was very emotional. And it was something that like months later I had to process and deal with. And I wasn't realizing what was going on. And so I think it's very important to realize that when people are going through something, we are not primed to think it in certain situations like this is sexual harassment or this is wrong or whatever, but it's just a lesson to all of us. It's like, just leave people alone. Don't make people uncomfortable. I'm sure I've done something to someone along the way that has made them uncomfortable. And for that, I apologize. And I would hope that somebody would tell me that. And I would want to own that because we as human beings, we can be horrible. And I think that the most important thing is that we just, stop and listen to each other and hear each other out and not qualify my abuse is better or stronger or worse than your abuse. And you can have this moment. You can't have this moment. Because I think that's kind of what's gotten us where we are now. And I think it's important to just listen and connect and just say, I believe you. You don't have to top a story. You don't have to, negate. You just listen. That's all. All right, let's have a show. Well, hello, guys. I'm sitting here with...
Oh, hi. I didn't see you there.
Oh, sure. Oh, hello. What happened? I'm sitting here with the wonderful and fantastic James Urbaniak and Roz Dresfeles.
Hey, girl.
How's it going?
So good. How are you?
We're great.
Very happy to be here.
I'm so happy to be here.
I mean it.
I mean, I'm thrilled. I'm also I'm thrilled that you're not going to do that crazy voice the whole time, Roz.
What are you talking about?
Who is this?
This is me now.
We're getting really real and honest about who we are. And
I'm going to do this guy. Okay. He's one of my uncles from Bayonne, New Jersey. Hey, Jimmy, you still acting?
Do you really have an uncle like that?
I'm 100.
Oh, my God.
100 uncles who all sound like that.
Oh, my God. I love
it. Hey, Jimmy.
Still acting?
It's still acting.
Still acting?
It's, oh my God, I love that. I love that so much. Also, like, what if the answer was no? Like, where would they go from there? Like, you know.
No, no, I stopped. I gave it up.
Yeah, exactly. It's just
good to know.
It's done. All right, moving
on. I assume
our
no one in my family had any connection to show business whatsoever. Is that the same with you? Or,
sure. Yeah, same with me.
Yeah.
How did you get started? And how, yeah.
In elementary school, I used to do plays and things.
Uh-huh. Yeah, same.
And
here.
It was always taken to be good.
Yes.
I had a lot of energy.
Right.
And I enjoyed that sort of thing.
Wait, what were your high school play roles? That's always my favorite thing.
Love
I talk to people about
too.
That all the time.
Well, here's the thing. I did a lot of plays, like in elementary school, for like third, fourth, and fifth grade, all the teachers used to do a part of the day where they would do what they call drama or dramatics.
Okay, great.
And they would do we would do sketches and things and write our own.
How great.
It was great. And I realized later that that was not totally common.
It's very rare.
School system.
Yeah.
And especially, I mean, maybe now because like the world has sort of like become, you know, way more savvy to comedy and sketch and improv and all that kind of stuff with the internet. But I mean, that's only been the last like, you know, 5 or 10 years. I mean, that's really cool that you guys were doing.
Yeah. And I think that was kind of formative.
Right.
Doing that at that age. And then in high school, I did less. I did I was in the chorus of a community theater production of Cabaret.
Oh, sure.
Because
yes.
I was blonde boy back then.
Oh, sure.
I
played a good Aryan. Tomorrow Belongs to
I
Me.
I sure did.
Yes.
And at one point, I didn't get tall till I was 16. So
okay.
When I was like 14, I was very skinny and very short. And I remember once the director picked me up and placed me somewhere else.
Wow.
Physically
on stage.
Picked you up.
Yeah, yeah. Because he figured it'd be
when
quicker
you were 14.
Than, something like that.
Wow.
And at the time,
old.
I thought, that's a little
inappropriate.
Inappropriate.
Yeah. Did you get picked up a lot? I know a lot of short, small people talk about that they get picked up and tossed around a lot.
I wasn't terribly bullied, but I guys would grab me and just so I couldn't walk and then let me go, things like that. I remember once when I was a little kid and I was buying clothes with my dad and we were living in Bayonne where I lived until I was 8. So I was under 8. I might have been like 6 or 7.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy in the store actually picked me up to kind of, I don't know, to chalk my pants or something.
Uh-huh.
And he said to my dad, "Unbelievable," meaning how little I was.
Wow.
For my age. Yeah.
And you'll never forget that.
No, of course.
There's one of those things when they say, because growing up, I had really big ears and really big feet.
Yes.
And I was digging through a bunch of old things that I had written because I was trying to find my high school graduation speech for this show that I'm doing in New York in a few weeks. And so I was going through all these things that my mom had sent me. And I remember I read this thing that I'd written in like fifth or sixth grade about if there was one thing I could change about my body, and it was my ears and how much I hated my big ears. And they were, it all came back, like what a sore of, you know, like, you know, what a sore spot it was, because people would flick them or make fun of them or call
yes.
me Dumbo or whatever. And I still have big ears, but I have a big head now and I'm grown ass 6'3", 200 pound man. So you don't really notice it, but they were the first thing to grow on me. And I had really big feet and to this day, I hate my feet. And they are by far the worst part of my body. But I remember
I'm glancing down now.
They're huge, but I mean, they're 12s. They're not like the biggest in the world, but they also are really, really flat. And they're like, I have a lot.
Me too, Drew.
Really?
My feet are so flat that a podiatrist once gaped at my X-ray.
I had the same thing. That's so crazy.
Incredible.
Did you step out of the pool and make a completely flat footprint?
Well, I only made the footprint I made. I never thought about it. But I have no arch.
I mean, you know, there's no
archless.
Oh, so yours
heel.
Is like the full
it's
foot.
It's like a palm print.
Me too.
Yeah. So there's no arch. And I remember going to a shoe store when I was probably around the same age, or fourth, fifth grade, and having big feet then, and the shoe salesman going, "Wow, I hope you grow into those feet." And it's one of those things that like... You know, just adults, you don't think when you're having a kid and you're like that. And I remember
being
like, I was so traumatized by that.
You talk about the cruelty of children, but the cruelty of adults to children, just saying stuff like that.
Unbelievable. And then you're like, what are you supposed to win in that moment? And is the kid supposed to find that hilarious? And like, I hope so too. Or God, you're hilarious. You should do comedy instead of selling shoes. Like,
I think adults maybe forget how impressionable kids are.
They really do. And they forget that, like, teasing and joking about a kid's appearance is just kind of always off limits, no matter what it is.
It takes a little bit of time and practice to learn sarcasm or, you know, as a young kid, you're like, wait, what?
Right, exactly.
How are you in heels?
I am actually good in heels, like for the most part. I've learned how to, because I had to learn how to walk in shoes, like regular shoes. And so like heel toe is really hard for me. I have to constantly, I mean, my mom used to always go heel toe when I would walk because I would just flap along. Like my feet would just like smack the ground like ducks. And so, so I don't know if it's like, I don't know, but I can do heels if I can find size 14s. I mean, it's just finding the size shoe that's
Have you ever had, I forget what they're called, arch thingies?
I have had arch supports. Yeah. I have had arch supports and they have helped. And I should get them again because they do, you know, because it affects your posture and everything. It absolutely
I had gotten
them
many years ago, like over 10 years ago. Because I'd never gotten them. And I went to this one foot guy, the guy who gaped. He was like, you should really have arch supports. He was like, do your feet hurt when you walk? And I said, not really.
No, mine either.
No, mine are fine.
Yeah.
I think it's a myth, all those guys in World War II who couldn't go because they had flat feet.
Absolutely. But I loved it. Growing up, I was like, I'll never be drafted.
Yeah, I'll never be drafted. Exactly.
I didn't realize I was gay, but I was like, I know I got flat feet, so this is why I'll never go to the war.
Yeah. That's the reason.
Yeah, I was so happy.
Oh, I have terrible feet, too.
Flat feet.
Yeah.
I have terrible feet because I worked in a theme park for years.
What theme park did you?
We're not going to talk about it. Yeah, we're not going to. I can't reveal too much. But
oh, okay.
Did you have a great adventure there?
It was an adventure.
How many flags were there?
Not too many flags at this one. But yeah, I have the worst because the shoes that I had to wear was a specific. I was a performer and it was a specific type of shoe I had to wear. And now I wear heels all the time, and I'm getting close to having to be a flats drag queen.
Really?
Yeah, my feet are real bad. Yeah. I'm good friends with a podiatrist as well.
Yeah,
foot problems.
Foot
the newest
problems.
Podcast.
Let's take some calls.
Exactly. You have feet problems. How do yours hurt? Talk about your bunions. I think it's really good to check in with that kind of stuff because it's like your knees. It's like those are parts of your body. You know, you just really got to take care of those.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, I don't want to not be able to walk or perform.
And, you know, and wear flats. Who cares? No one's going to. I mean, if that's.
Jackie B does
like,
it.
Absolutely. And there's nobody better. So, like, if you, you know, and it's like, if you can't walk in heels, then don't do it. It's just like, don't force something just because. And, you know, and make a bit out of it, you know.
Well, I'm always
and
like,
Roz dressed for Les, you know, she's casual.
Exactly. You know? Well, I'm always like, if people are so concerned about something like that, then I must be boring or something.
Right.
I need to change something if that's what they're focused on.
Right. Well, and that's the same thing about, like, you know, people that do perfect makeup. It's like, I don't care about
that.
I don't care if you have, if, you know, it's just like when, you know, it's like, I don't, when I go to Broadway and see shows and I see someone who has the perfect singing voice, but if they're dead inside, I'm like, you're perfectly trained. You're a product of this perfect, but I like messy. Yes. I like a little bit. I'd rather see somebody that's real who might be a little bit, you know. Like when I saw Cabaret, to speak of that, like Natasha Richardson, right? Yeah, Natasha Richardson was just heartbreaking. And she wasn't really a singer, but I was like, I'll never forget her performance. And I don't remember somebody who's just going to give the, like, you know, the perfect thing. I don't care about
flawless. That's always an interesting dichotomy, like technique and heart or whatever you're saying with the art.
Mm-hmm.
And you need a balance of both for something to land.
Yes.
But if something's just purely technical, it can be impressive, but...
Right. You can be like, that's very good.
It's not personal.
It's not at all. There's not a soul to it. And yes, you don't want just complete heart and no...
There's
no, you know, training or talent.
When
involved,
I was in New York, I became like a connoisseur of acting styles.
Yes.
And you can, like, I remember going to a play once. the scene was two people, a professor and a student.
Was this Oleana?
No. This was Julianne Moore played the professor.
Oh, okay.
Mm. Yes, it was a reverse gender Oleana.
Okay.
And when she called that boy a cunt,
the
dry eye in the house.
Oh, it was sad. Okay.
No, it wasn't Oleana. But the scene was a student talking to her advisor in a chair in an office. And I'm watching the scene, and it's a young woman playing the student.
Mm-hmm.
And I went, Juilliard.
Wow.
I could tell she was Juilliard trained based on how she sat in the chair and spoke to the other character.
Wow.
because, and I know a lot of Juilliard people, and they develop their own style eventually, but there can be a thing where there's a very specific, very technically impressive thing mm-hmm. that they do, but it doesn't feel personal, and it doesn't necessarily feel real when you sort of see a young actor just sort of doing that technique that they've learned.
Wow.
Which is a kind of pressurized physicality and kind of vocal domination.
I would love to talk to you because like somebody like I just saw earlier this year, I saw Michael Urie do The Government Inspector, and it's one of the most brilliant comedic performances I've ever seen in my
life. I bet.
And his ability to, and he went to Juilliard, is a male, but I'm sure he would agree with you on something. It's like, and I would love to talk to him. Or hear that, because I remember
I've had this
going
conversation
to see,
with a lot of graduates, because it's sort of a little
yes, because
obsession
you,
of mine.
You have to be above, like, the you know, the training is like incredible, and it's the best, you know, because I've been so impressed, because when I saw him do that, and like Jessica Chastain is another actor who
That's
went
right.
to Juilliard and who was in his class, and I know there are a lot, you know, that, and you know, or like Kevin Klein was a Juilliard as well, yes?
I believe so, because he was, I think that was early acting company, which
with
was
Patti
the Juilliard offshoot that John Houseman.
Yes. And like, these are like some of my very favorites, but
oh, yeah.
you know, you learn, you like, you have to sort of learn that, you know, they came in with raw talent. They had to learn this other thing, and then they had to sort of transcend.
Well, that's the thing.
Exactly.
Because when I don't have any formal training, I went to a community
really?
College. Yeah. But then
wow.
I had my own company for years, and that became sort of my own training.
Your own theater company.
Yes.
Okay.
But when I was like 18, 19, after high school, I was just going to a community college, studying different things, but always doing plays.
Uh-huh.
But I started taking classes in New York City. And at the time, I didn't understand what technique was. I couldn't wrap my head around it.
Right.
I had energy.
Right.
And I had instincts. And I stood out as someone with no training
mm-hmm.
in my community theater plays in college. But I didn't know what it was. And I took classes at HB.
Oh, yes.
Famous
sure.
acting
sure.
studio
yeah.
in New York
uh-huh.
with the old character actor William Hickey.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Remember
totally.
The name William Hickey. Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
And he was great. And looking back, I understand what he was doing. But at the time, I didn't.
Right.
I kind of had to get out into the world and then later add up the stuff I learned in that
yes,
class.
Yes. And I think you have to do that everywhere because I never did formal training either. I mean, I went to a liberal arts school and I was a theater major and I studied. Thing, you know, I learned mostly from just doing a lot of plays. And then mm-hmm. I did, you know, I took all the acting classes and the movement. And I learned about, you know, Linkletter, you know, voice technique and Alexander technique and all that stuff. We learned it, but it was so surface. It was so on top of, I had to go to chemistry class after that. Like it was really good training, but it was, they also don't expect you to be an actor for a living there. You don't, that's not what they're there to do. And so, and then I went into the Groundlings and sort of that, you know, and again, the Groundlings is really great improv training. But when they go up to like the sketch stuff, it's like throw it up and see if it works or doesn't. Like they don't really teach you how to write a sketch. You kind of, it's all trial and error at that point. So the school really changes its MO from improv into the sketch. And they also just kind of go, you have to know how to act. Coming into this school. Like, we don't teach acting, but you have to be a good performer in order to do this. So you kind of have to figure it out. And I think it's so interesting to hear people's perspective. Because I used to, when I was at Wake Forest in North Carolina, we used to go and see shows at North Carolina School of the Arts. And they have such a specific style of acting that drove me crazy. And again, there's incredible actors that have come out of all of these places. But there was some teacher or somebody that was encouraging actors to smack their legs whenever they needed to make points, and so they would walk around and they would just smack their legs, making points.
Fascinating.
And it was, we just noticed it. And once you noticed it, you couldn't unnotice it. Like, you couldn't focus on the play because you're watching everyone walking around beating themselves up.
That sounds like it would be an exercise, but it was actually...
Yes. And I think there was like a literal thing to it, or they had just seen someone that was so good.
Right.
Or someone really nailed the thigh slap.
And
they studied that.
Because these things
that.
Can start somewhere and then they just work their way through history.
Because,
you know, like that, it's possible that teacher saw an actor do that on stage once.
Uh-huh.
He did it.
And he was maybe amazing.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, yes.
And because I become obsessed with moments like that, like small gestures, throwaway things.
Yes.
And a lot of them are floating around that just people have borrowed from each other.
Right. And it's fascinating. Well, I think about when I was teaching and I used to see so many women doing Kristen Wiig. And it was like at the Groundlings, you know, they would do their characters and they would be, it would be an offshoot of something Kristen did. And I went through this, the Groundling, through the school with Kristen. And so like, she was the only one doing that then, like these really weird women that she would come in and bring that would,
She also keys into a very modern sort of female energy. I don't even know how to describe it.
Yes. But when
she, like, not even her more exaggerated characters. She just has, when she's playing sort of something more naturalistic.
Oh, absolutely.
She just had a kind of energy and I don't even know how to describe it. Just quality that seemed new.
Yes, absolutely. And I remember when she was at the Groundlings, though, she, I mean, her characters were all just these. I mean, it was, you know, Target Lady and all that kind of those people that, you know, you would know. But they were just these weird women that she pointed at. Like, you know, there was one lady that went door to door, like a saleswoman that came to her door in real life. And Kristen was like, would you like a cup of coffee? And like brought her in and like sat down and brought her in. But it was like she was so attuned to weird behavior and weird ways of speaking. And just, and she would just, and she had a wild imagination. She would take one phrase and like spin a whole character around
thing,
it.
Yeah, or she'll just take one little physical quality or expression or something.
Yes.
And it's like a great caricaturist.
Right.
It's like a Hirschfeld cartoon.
And she, yes, and she just paints around it. And I just noticed, and I would always, you know, and it was what she did. And it was like, that was her. But
that's the thing, it's what she did. I don't like when so many people.
And then a lot of other people, and a lot of it is like students are just learning and they're not even realizing that they're doing that.
Yeah.
They're not even going, I'm gonna kidnap her characters and, you know, or hijack her characters is a better word. Instead, they love her work. And I've even had some students in the pad that I'm like, that I've pulled aside and said, you're great, you've got to stop watching Kristen Wiig.
Because
it's rubbing off on you. And it's like Chris Farley did that with a lot of men, like a lot of guys that would come in with this Chris Farley or Will Ferrell energy. Because these people become iconic by doing what they do. And then everybody kind of does that because they think that's comedy. And when you're learning, you're kind of going, that's the thing. But it is interesting with these, you know, these acting schools that they do teach a certain, they teach an aesthetic. And it's like, if you climb to that and you're able to achieve all those, all the math of that, you'll do well. But then you have to be able to, you know, sort of learn that and kind of throw it
now,
away.
I have to, this is not really a sidebar, but I have to go back to the North Carolina thing because this is true. And this is the kind of thing I remember. When I first started doing stuff in New York, I had met a director. She was getting her master's at Columbia for directing, and I first moved in and started doing student. I wasn't going to Columbia, but I was her friend, and she was directing and needed actors. So, and that's how it all started with me in New York. So young actors who would come to New York would audition for these Columbia student plays. They would advertise in backstage.
Mm-hmm.
And Richard Register. Of Gans and the Register.
Of course.
Who I'm, you know, right?
Yes, of course.
Was in the cast of this play. And he was a recent graduate of North Carolina School of the Arts.
I didn't know that he went there.
Yes,
I know
I'm almost
from
positive
here.
That he went there. And he did a gesture. We were doing like an old Greek comedy, like The Birds by Aristophanes or something, or whoever wrote The Birds. His character, it was very comedic. And first day of rehearsal, his character regrets something. And then very comedically, Richard pretended to stab himself in compunction for this.
Uh-huh.
So he held a little, there may have been a prop where he just put his fist like a knife. And then he stabbed himself repeatedly in the chest really quickly. Like, what have I done? What have I done? And it was the funniest thing I'd ever seen. And I remember thinking at the time, wow, this guy's really trained. Because it was really clean gesture.
Yes, yes.
But it was also him slapping his hand against his body.
Right.
What is that North Carolina School of the Arts?
I don't know.
The body
it's the flagellating. It's the South. Like, beat yourself up. You
slap
know,
your knee.
It's
that's
interesting
how
you
make
when you hate your body.
And so is Richard doing a variation on the thigh
that
slap.
That is very strange.
Ah,
I love that.
Interesting.
But that's
Ross,
what you have
about
to
you?
Do.
Where did you, where did you
where did I train,
train
in my clownery?
Where did you get your clown?
I mean, I'm not really necessarily an actor, so I never really studied.
But you're wonderful. You do the Golden Girls with us, and you're such a natural.
Thank you.
You hold your own against a bunch of, I mean, talk about clown show.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Oh, my gosh. I can't wait till we get to this revelation because I've got things to say. I was a theater kid.
And you did theme parks. You performed at theme parks.
Did theme parks as well.
That's training.
It is. Oh, it's a whole other kind of training because it's dealing with how to talk to all different kinds of people from all over the world and different situations and staying in character.
Yeah.
But I've learned a lot from doing as well. I mean, I do a lot of stand-up, and that, too, is something that I guess you could take class to learn certain techniques, mm-hmm. but it's very similar to what you guys were saying. Sometimes you do see techniques that people use that they've kind of picked up from other comics that they've seen. Mm-hmm. And like what you were saying with like the Kristen Wiig thing, that's been a problem, too, where people see other comics. They kind of just hear a joke thrown away, and then they get accused of stealing jokes because they use that joke.
Right.
Robin Williams, that used to happen to mm-hmm. a lot.
Right. Well, things come into the ether, and people don't realize that they maybe have stolen, or like you have a sort of a collective sense of humor.
Right. And just parallel thought.
I'm also fascinated by acting styles throughout time.
It like, is interesting, isn't it? How, like, Rebel Without a Cause was considered the most naturalistic acting when it came out. And you watch it now, and it is, like, kabuki.
Well, James Dean is doing a form of naturalism, but most of the other kids are acting like they're in Guys and Dolls or something.
Oh, yeah.
Let's go!
Natalie Wood is insane in that movie. Because we watched it again, Lisa. I mean, I'm just like, the rubbing of the lipstick all over her face, it's crazy. And it was just like, kids are wild, you know? And it's like, I'm sure that was so fascinating at the time when it came out, but yeah, there's just, you know, and I guess it was way more naturalistic than, you know, Humphrey Bogart, you know, but it's like, it's crazy. Yeah.
Well, yeah, there's a parallel in The Wild One where Brando is doing this new form of post-war naturalism, for lack mm-hmm. of a better description, mm-hmm. but a lot of the other actors in that are doing this kind of presentational, almost Broadway style, which uh-huh. is kind of hilarious because they're playing motorcycle gang members.
I love
it. But they all seem like they're...
I've never seen The Wild One.
...in a musical comedy. Oh. Brando is really great. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen it in a long time.
Sure.
But there's this, you sort of see two... It's sort of an interesting period where you can see two different styles of acting kind of colliding with each other in the same movie.
Right, right.
See, that's the hard thing that I've always had is pulling it back because I'm just so used to the stage and doing drag and I've been filming a few things here and there lately and I don't know. How do you balance that?
Always very well. Sometimes you can't. The hardest thing is when you're on something for one day and you don't know what movie you're in, you know?
Right.
Because
we've all seen that where you're like, that person's in a completely different movie than everyone
completely.
Else.
And they don't tell you. And you don't have any footage to, you know, and it's not like you have a TV show that you can watch ahead of time and go, this is
style.
The vibe of
but,
this show.
Yeah, it has to be. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt
you,
Drew.
No. Go for it.
But the thing about pulling back, it's like, it's not really about is it big or small. It's just about is it personal and is it about something?
Yes.
One of my favorite actors is Gene Wilder.
Sure.
You can't accuse him of being naturalistic or
no,
even
right.
small. He's
no,
really big.
Yes.
But he's so intense. He's like the Brando of comedy.
Oh, I know.
Because he's super real. And
then no one can do what he did.
No. And I've tried.
I've tried as well because I did a fundraiser a few years ago. We did a reading of Young Frankenstein as a fundraiser. And so, I mean, I've been told, especially when my hair isn't insanely, you know, at its longest, that I look like Gene Wilder. And so they asked me to do Dr. Frankenstein. It was impossible. I got negative laughs. And it was because there's like... And I'm watching the movie and I'm just trying to do what he did because it's not about making it it's like for a benefit and people want to see you doing the movie.
Right.
They don't want to see what's your take on this?
Your interpretation.
On this test.
Exactly.
You know, they want to see the characters come alive, you know? And I really worked and tried and I it was so hard. And I was like, this man was so singular and not that somebody else couldn't do him. But he makes it look so easy, and the screaming, and his angle, his levels, and his ability. And yes, it is so personal. And what I always love is something that a quote that Alan Cumming said which is you can be as big as you want to be as long as you mean it.
That's
and I love
totally
that.
True.
And that's the thing about like people in real life are over the top at times.
Oh, 100%.
And that's when you want to see people. I don't want to see. I'm sorry, but when I watch Twilight, that's my example, and I know they're, but that style of acting is as stylized as you know Joanne
100%.
Worley on Laugh-In. You know, like that's sort of like, hey, what's up? Nothing. What's up to you?
We're three. The three of us are talking in a room right now in pretty full voices.
Yes.
We can all hear each other and we're mic'd. We don't have to speak loud, but we are because we're energized and communicating with each other. But there's a kind of movie acting where we'd all be talking like this.
I know.
And there's an understanding that that's more real.
Well, and I
but you're right. It is no more real than Joanne
Worley. It's just as much as... yes. And it's like a... To me, it's like a... And I think... that, you know, it's like the moment is, and also what we're going to be put in is we're going to be put in bigger role, like people that have bigger energy, because that's what we do. And so even if it's, you know, and a good director can just pull it down. Sometimes it's just a matter of going, okay, the camera's just right here versus an audience that's this far away.
Yes.
So it's just about adjusting like that kind of stuff. But, you know, yeah, I think sometimes too that like I've tried to be really real and bring it down and I lose everything and I kind of have everybody going, looking at me like, why did we bring you in to do this?
If that's
we don't,
how
you
I
don't
feel.
Do what you do.
My instinct is
so
like...
So I don't think you should worry about it too much. I think there's such a thing where people think like there's theater acting and there's film acting. And I think that's bullshit. I think it's like, it's what's
agree,
real, what's
totally.
True. And there are different moments that you have to be like, oh, in this moment, you know, the show I'm doing right now, my solo show, it's set outside. And I learned a lot. I did it one time literally outside. And I learned more from doing it outside just because of feeling that energy of like how you talk to each other outside versus how you talk to each other inside. That had more to do with it than I'm in the theater versus I'm on film.
And I'm fairly loud in real life. I've been hushed in restaurants many times.
Yes, me too.
Conversations are had significant others look at me going, keep it down. The man is looking at you.
Right.
But there's a sort of bizarre idea that talking super quietly is realistic.
I know.
But in a way, like, there's lots of great acting in silent movies.
Sure.
There's some great acting that's very natural and very real. And there's a kind of presentational acting that we look at as kind of dated. Like, why are they making these big gestures?
Mm-hmm.
But I think in 100 years, people will look at Twilight or whatever and go, why are they talking so quietly?
I know.
What's going on?
If they look at it at all. But it's like, yeah. By the way,
I've never seen a Twilight movie, I can't even say that I have. I guess either. Maybe
on a plane I've seen
but
more of
it. But there is a kind of acting that young... Well, and there's a lot of sighing in that acting, too, when young people are upset on screen. They go,
I know.
I just don't know.
It's all that just
you're like
the Hollywood
the
huff,
and
you call it.
It's just like...
it's just so hard.
Everyone's just like kind of casually a mystery, you know what I mean? And just like, whatever. It's like, you do this thing, that's interesting, that's acting. It's also, I just don't think... It will never be how I perform. I'll never... But, you know, I mean, I look at people like, you know, William H. Macy, and I'm like, oh, my God, I want to be that subtle at times. I want to be able to do, like, so little with that. Yeah, that's amazing. But he's also can be insanely big.
Yeah, it's he's like, really theatrical.
So it's like, you know, I think it's, like, about range. And,
also, the late, great Phil Hoffman was super theatrical.
Absolutely. And real.
And very real. But he didn't pretend to be naturalistic.
Right. And I think that's the thing about when you find your uniqueness and yourself, that's the stuff that people want you to bring to the table, you know?
And it takes it's hard to remember that.
Yes.
In recent times, I have done TV gigs where there's one very recently where I know in the scene I was doing Gene Wilder because I just watched like Blazing Saddles or something.
Uh-huh.
And then I watched it and went, it's fine, but it's not me. And this is my new mantra for me to try to be better. Don't do a thing. Just behave.
Oh, I love
Don't
that.
Don't do a thing.
Don't do a thing.
Don't do a thing.
That's
so when you were doing Gene Wilder, you were doing a thing.
Right.
Whereas Gene Wilder was just doing something that came out of him.
Absolutely.
So yeah, that's my thing.
And
it's
that's
sort of about
so
decluttering
true.
It. Just
yeah.
Yeah.
This is and great it's also, for me.
Don't
to hear
do a
and
level.
It's also simple. It's also more simple than we think it is. I mean, I think people get thousands and thousands of dollars from green talent, but just moves to towns by telling them it's so much more difficult. It's like the therapist that wants to keep you sick a little bit so you'll keep coming back. And like, you need to do this and then think of this moment and then hold on to this letter and this and that. And it's like, it really is like behave truthfully in imaginary circumstances. Like, believe what you're saying, but listen, react. Like, it's so much simpler than we kind of tell ourselves sometimes, and we make it so complicated. And sometimes it's like, no, just believe. And your truth is going to be different from somebody else's.
That's right.
And so there's no right or wrong. It is, as long as it's right for you. The only way you're going to go wrong is when you go.
That's very true.
And when you do a thing.
It's not only that it's right for you emotionally, but behaviorally. Mm-hmm. The how loud your voice is, how gestural you are. Mm-hmm. But those are all personal things. Mm-hmm. You can be very gestural and loud and,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Nathan Lane isn't necessarily doing a thing. He's doing himself.
Absolutely.
He's expressing himself. So it's not about some sort of idea of naturalism and underplaying. It's just about honesty and trusting yourself, which is hard. It's hard to trust yourself.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Because like the stuff that I do and I've done with you is like the real high camp, draggy type stuff. But it's still true. Like you still have to be truthful about what
you're doing. You have to be in every moment. You have to be mm-hmm. like away. Like, you know, we're in the basement of a Mexican restaurant. People are right on top of you, and you have to. There's no way you can make eye contact in that theater. You have to be very presentational and turned out and looking out and. But you have to be listening and connected because the second you drop out, mm-hmm. they're right there. They can see you. Yeah. So it is, you know, and there is, you have to learn how to do that. And every time we have somebody new down at Casita del Campo, we're like, just so you know, you're not going to make eye contact. Don't turn because you're going to upstage. The way this place is laid out, you have to just turn out. But that doesn't mean be cardboard either, you know, like you have to.
But like great performances are very seductive, especially to other performers. So it's countless times I've been like, wow, that's so great. I'm going to act like that person.
Sure.
I'm going to do that gesture.
Right.
Yeah.
Be like Gene Wilder.
Right.
Just know when it's not really me.
Right. It's not him. Yeah.
But when you're doing an actual impression of somebody, how does that?
Well, I've played a couple of actual people.
Because mm-hmm. I'm playing Gina Davis's role in Peaches Christ's version of Sheetlejuice. It's like a drag version of Beetlejuice.
Yes,
nice.
Please.
And
I'm
Bianca
so glad
Del
you're
Rio,
doing that. Congrats.
Thank you. Bianca Del Rio plays Beetlejuice, and I'm playing.
Oh my God! What a dream.
Yes, it's such a dream come true.
Yes. Yes.
But so I'm thinking about this acting stuff.
That's
lately.
A little different because you do have to. Pay homage to Gina Davis' performance.
Right.
Because you can't just do your own thing. Because it's different from we're doing an original production of Beetlejuice somewhere and we're mounting it and I can do my own thing.
Right.
People are coming because they want to see that.
What they know
that
from
sliver.
The screen. Yeah.
I think also just like everybody does it differently. Some people are brilliant impressionists. I am not. I take a sliver of what I think their soul sounds like and I just try to go from there. And I try not to, I watch it a bunch of times and I just try to let it land somehow, but I don't think of it as like I have to copy every mannerism.
Yeah,
every
no, and I and, yeah, yeah, I mean I'm not
boring.
That great a mimic either. But when I've done things like that, it's more about my feelings about the performance.
Mm-hmm.
So what are the elements that land for you in Gina Davis's performance? And it's almost like a conversation. This is your conversation about her in
that
movie.
Well, I think when I did, we did Mommy Dearest. We did Mommy Dearest on stage with Alexandra Billings, who gave the most incredible performance I made. I mean, it was so great. She was Joan Crawford, and I was Christina, and Diana Scarwood is so dull in that movie. Like as much as Faye Dunaway has been made fun of for doing Mommy Dearest, I'm like, she's brilliant. She's doing something.
I love it.
Diana Scarwood is so punishingly boring that was my comment. Was like, I'm gonna try to be as boring as I can be because there's no way. And in the way Mommy Dearest is set up, you're not gonna win. You're Christina.
Now I haven't seen that in a long time. By the way, I gotta say, sidebar: she's not boring in Silkwood.
She's great.
She's quite flamboyant and hilarious in Silkwood.
She is. I haven't seen Silkwood in forever.
Yeah, well, she's like Cher's lover, and she's this sort of she's like the southern.
She can be great and then things, but
kind of sassy southern girl. But
and Cher is
maybe
great,
she made a decision to be more. Well, if you're playing against the great Faye Dunaway playing Joan Crawford, one may want to pull back.
Like, first movie, also
back
like
the house, she's
clearly a terrible director, and them not knowing what.
Yeah,
the
well,
movie
I do
was.
Remember it's not really a good film.
Oh, it's a horrible movie, yes. And it's actually you know a giant lie. So I have as much as it's such a gay camp classic, I have a hard time watching it. I have a hard time enjoying it.
I've wanted to revisit it for a while.
It's for me. I just remember watching it as a kid and being so traumatized because it's so. Horrifying. When you find it, it was so much of it is lies, and so much of it is a disgusting, sad, you know, tale told by a awful, vengeful daughter who wants to get back on her mother, who I'm sure was not a lovely, warm, incredible woman, but this is a lie. And
well,
so,
what's so sad for me about it is that in the drag world, Mommy Dearest is huge.
Yes.
And unfortunately, that's the Joan Crawford that is always portrayed. Whenever there's a Joan Crawford impersonator, it's always wire hangers.
Yes,
and,
yes.
But it's like,
I know. That's right. That's I never thought of it that way, but the great impressionists do the official impression.
Yes.
Like, there was a comic in the 60s named Will Jordan who came up with the phrase really big show.
Okay.
Because it was just, you could do a good Sullivan by saying that phrase, but Sullivan didn't necessarily say that. I think it's one of those mythic
things. Oh, isn't that funny?
But now everyone, still today, they do Will Jordan's Ed Sullivan.
Right. Yes. And
so everyone does Faye Dunaway's
Joan
Crawford.
That's for sure.
As opposed to
and
doing
really
Joan Crawford.
That, yeah. And I wasn't the world's biggest fan of that feud show. I had a lot of, you know, but I thought, oh my God, Jessica Lange was amazing.
Fantastic.
And I loved that she gave Joan Crawford humanity,
yes,
and refused to play it like a drag queen,
yes,
you know, and,
beautiful,
you know, because.
But played that regal and, dare I say, sense of entitlement that a great movie star should have.
Yes.
But also you could see her emotional life,
yes,
in there.
And it was, and she wasn't really doing an impression of Joan Crawford. I mean, you know,
no,
she was,
and that's
living
the great
her,
thing. She's exactly what we're talking about,
yeah,
which you should aspire to. It's,
yes,
sort of, it's also her conversation with Joan Crawford.
Yes.
She's saying something.
I love it. Okay, I want to hear some stories from you guys.
That's right. We're
supposed
to reveal
stories.
Stuff.
I mean, I love this conversation so much. I'm like, we could talk about this for 4 hours.
I could seriously.
And like I said, I'm learning
talk about
so
acting
such a nerd about
that podcast.
Well, because I'm like the one.
Week.
I know, same
I'm
here.
Like the one person amongst actors always that like I just kind of I'm absorbing. I'm used to this kind of a conversation. I'm learning a lot from both of you. So thank you.
Oh my God! Of course. Likewise. I love this. I love this chatter. Who wants to go first?
Okay, I'll go first.
I'm waiting for this
I love
story.
This chatter. I'm going to end it. Who wants to go first?
This makes me so nervous because...
I cannot wait.
I have revealed a lot about myself. And, you know, like I have a podcast which you've been on.
Yes.
And I talk about, you know, my life and stuff. But this is one thing I have not talked about. But you know what? I'm going to do it. I'm going to do
it
today.
I love it.
And I feel like maybe we've talked about this before. I'm not sure. I come from a family where my father, I'll just say it, my father was a clown.
Well, he was literally a clown.
Literally a clown.
I did not know that.
Pro. He was pro.
A professional.
Wow.
Made
now,
money.
Now, what kind of clown? Like, did he go to like, the circus or birthday parties?
He worked for the fire department for like 30 years. And starting from like the 80s, he was this fire safety clown.
Okay.
Still does it to this day. This is like making me nervous talking about this because I've never shared it with anyone.
I love it.
And it's like, it's funny. Like, naturally, I grew up to be a drag queen.
Of course. It was in you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
So that was, you know.
What is his clown? Does he have a name?
We're not going to. I'm not.
Okay.
I got to draw the line somewhere.
So what does he
I'm
look like?
I'm flashing a little on Jim Carrey and in Living Color, obviously.
Yes.
His chief character.
Or that was Damon Wayans.
Oh, yeah. He did, what was the Homie the Clown?
Oh, no, but Jim Carrey did
Fire Marshal Bill.
Who did
Fire Marshal Bill.
Yes.
Okay. Now it's
kind of a mixture of both of those.
Okay,
that's
great.
My
Please.
Father.
Got it.
Yes, exactly.
Please. True. Please. Don't think I'm
I love how I'm like, schooling you on In Living Color. No, that was Kelly Cofield. No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So what was I going to say about that? So, you know, it's something that's like... normal to me that my dad was a clown. And when I was a young kid, it was definitely a point of insecurity because he would be fully dressed up and do these presentations at our school. So I'd be like in the classroom and then all of a sudden, knock, knock, here comes the silly clown with his horn and his... And everyone's like, that's your dad.
Oh, wow.
So a little traumatized, but I, you know... I was always like the kind of kid that, and I guess I still probably am this way, where rather than, like, I know the jokes are coming, I know I'm going to get bullied about this, I'm just going to embrace it. And, like, mm-hmm. How are you going to laugh? You know, that technique,
sure,
that bully technique. So I decided, like, you know what? I think it's kind of cool. Like, I don't know. It's interesting. Now, mind you.
But aren't you glad now that you had that, that you have a 100%. Performer for a father
100%.
Who understands
who totally
you
understands
are
what
and
I do.
What you do?
100% yes. understands what I
Absolutely.
Do. You know, clowning, I mean, it's such a silly thing. And sadly, it's kind of a tainted art form, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like it, and it, every time you see a
Captain
clown nowadays.
The Friedman's.
Yes.
You know, it's a hard.
Somebody,
you know,
John Wayne Gacy.
The first episode of Baskets is all about what a loser this guy is because he wants to be a clown.
Oh, I know,
Isn't
I love
that. Isn't
that
funny? Modern Family, there's that yes. storyline too.
Shortcuts, Ann Archer. Have you seen that movie?
I have not.
Mimes as well. Mimes are
Oh, nervous. Mimes, yeah.
Mimes are only made fun of dramatically.
100%.
Oh, sure. Or what's the one with
I kind of get that.
Bobcat Goldthwait, where he plays the clown.
Oh, with
Shakes
Julie Brown.
I would argue that that's a pro-clown movie.
And
I'm not making fun
movie.
Of their clownishness. It's just about them being in a subculture.
But
anyway,
it's sort of like the Tu Wong Fu thing where it's
sure.
like drag queens are always in drag. Always these clowns are always.
Yes,
whatever.
Yes, yes.
So, yeah, that's what's kind of unfortunate about it is, you know, it's like they're only here to make you laugh and have a good time and the theatrics of it. I love wigs and makeup and it's all
sure.
so fun and sweet.
Yeah.
And their role in the circus, like, sure, there's certain things about the circus that are very inhumane and whatever, but what the clowns do is humane and it's fun and it's camp and it's art and it's theater. And mm-hmm. I always was so drawn to that. And so I became a clown when I was 10 years old and let me tell you something. I had a small business I was running, and I was doing birthday parties.
This is fantastic.
Wow.
Honey, I was making $50 a party.
What?
I felt like, you know, it's so funny, it's so telling. My name was Rainbow the Clown.
Yes.
Yes, which I chose myself.
Absolutely.
Did you wear rainbow suspenders?
Yes, I did.
Nailed it.
How'd you know? Do I appear to be that type?
Mork.
Yeah, and then I went to the Ringling Brothers to see a performance and met this woman there. And she's like, oh, well, I do this other circus, and you want to come be a clown in the circus? And I was like, yeah. So me and my dad, when I was 10 years old, were in the circus, and I got to perform in stadiums.
Wow,
and that was my first time being under the lights and being, you know, in a stadium and learning choreography and all that.
Damn.
And so it's a very weird start to a career at 10 years old.
But it's so fitting. It's like, don't you?
It makes so much sense.
It feels very throwbacky, like vaudevillian. Like,
yes.
Oh, yeah.
Keaton, his parents were vaudevillians and he was in their act as a kid.
Yeah. So,
and I've talked about this before too, but growing up, my father would do characters on Saturday morning and my brother and I would order different characters out of my dad and he would be making breakfast and he would just do one character after another. And that's one of my greatest memories of my, one of my most vivid memories of my dad, almost every Saturday morning.
Yeah.
And he was such a performer himself. And then when I was in high school, I did drag with my dad at like a Lincoln County cancer variety show, which is what they called it. There was no art around the title. And it was all like all the men in town would dress up in this, like a beauty pageant. And I remember like my dad was like committed to playing this woman. And I have a picture of myself from high school. I'm 17 years old with my father and we're doing drag
special.
Together. You know, and I'm just so grateful for those moments now, like to look back and say, I'm so glad that, you know, even when I was, you know, 22 and moved out to LA and I was like, I want to do this in my life. And my parents thought I was crazy at first. And they were like, what are you doing? They can look back and say, well, it was already happening. You know what I mean? It wasn't just like, you know, I'm glad that I had some, prep for it and found some love for it, even though that my dad would never think like to do it for a living. That was ridiculous. But
well, this was like not my dad's only job. It was just like a side gig. Now
right,
he's retired and he's like trying to, God bless him. He's like, you're really trying, it's hard. You know, like, especially with It coming out and like American Horror Story had the whole clown storyline.
He's single-handedly bringing the clown back.
This poor guy. But like when I decided to start doing drag, I mean, which felt so natural, something that was like building up inside of me for all these years because I like missed the theatricality of clowning.
Mm-hmm.
Drag's a little bit more marketable these days. my family was at first kind of like, what is this? You know, because they're not the kind of people that would know much about drag. But I'm like, I was raised by a clown. Right. What do you expect?
Exactly. It's all in there.
I'm like, Mom, you're married to a clown.
Right.
You're a woman that's husband is a clown.
Yes. And it's interesting that a lot of people can accept drag queens mm-hmm. a lot easier than they can accept gay people. Like, that is like, you know, yeah. and not to talk about your family, but I mean, just like in audiences in general, it's like, they will love, like, Tupperware parties that drag queens do, or yeah. they will love, you know, and they've always, you know, it's like from, you know, Milton Berle and Flip Wilson and all the performers that have always done these drag characters, and that's sort of, it's a weird space that people love it. They
In the 70s, my dad's go-to impression was Flip Wilson as Geraldine.
My dad did really? The same thing.
You young people yeah. can look it up on YouTube.
The devil made me buy this dress.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
But one thing that I notice is from working, because I work like maybe half of my time in like comedy clubs and alternative show, like not necessarily gay shows as Ross Dressfuls doing stand-up and different things. As much as I do also in gay clubs, and it's different, the audience. And sometimes yeah. what I really, really try to avoid is just having the audience laughing at the fact that I'm a man dressed like a lady.
Oh, that's never interesting to me. That's
no.
never my joke. It's so about
And sometimes, and I get it, you know? Like, we were talking just before we started recording about, like, when I work in these comedy clubs, like, they don't know. Like, and I get it.
Sure.
I can't sit here and expect, like, you should know all about drag. We have right. our own TV show now.
Right.
But
you had, please tell who you had pop in and do your show.
Oh, yeah.
Week.
Oh, my God. I have the show called Ross's Humor Hole at the Hollywood Improv. And, you know, it's Hollywood. You never know who shows up. And this, I do so many shows now around town. And so it's sometimes it's kind of hard to get people to come. And we've been doing well recently. We had Kevin Nealon on the last one, and that was great. And this one, it was like kind of a late night show, and I was having a hard time getting tickets out, and I was a little nervous. And I was like, I need a miracle. And the miracle showed up in the form of Dave Chappelle.
I mean, that is amazing. That is so awesome.
He walks in, and he's like, what is this show? And I was like, oh, it's my show. And he's like, oh, was this a one-woman show? And of course, I'm in full drag. And I'm like, no, it's like a stand-up show. I'm the host. I'm a drag queen. And he was so respectful and so interested in what a drag queen comedian does. And I was talking to him about gay comedy, and I was explaining to him that, you know, this is where I like to book, you know, sort of mainstream comedians, alternative comedians, and also give a platform for my gay comedian friends, give them time, stage time that they might not otherwise get. And it's kind of just a fun mix of people. There was another show going on in the other room that was sold out. And he was like, well, do you want me to do the show? And I'm like, yeah. I mean, if you want. I mean, the other one's sold out. We don't have many tickets. He's like, don't worry. We will fill this place up. And so he got on the stage. He was very respectful. He did, you know, about a half hour. Of course, lit a cigarette. Like, you know, what are you going to tell him not to?
Yeah, I love
and,
that.
And he said, you know, he ended the set by saying, just so you guys know, this is all Ross Dressfuls' show. By the way, it was packed by the time he got up on stage. He said, this is her show. I want you to give it up for her. And, she has her own show here, and I've worked here for years, and she is among the best of the best. So please give her all your respect.
Oh, my God.
And it was
wonderful.
Just, it was such a nice thing to hear from somebody of his caliber.
Yeah. And somebody that, you know, I looked up to so much. And I,
oh, my gosh.
And I know that, like, he did get in some hot water, and I haven't done my research, and I don't go online here. But he did make a trans joke and got into some trouble about that. And I love hearing that he's on the right side. You know, I mean, he's not an enemy.
Absolutely.
And, like, you know, comedians make jokes, and they're going to say things that maybe trigger someone or might be inappropriate or might be insensitive, and that's kind of what they do. But when you know someone where their heart is, it's really nice to hear that. Because also, he could have just walked by. He didn't have to stop in.
Oh, and not,
he didn't do any of that for his ego. He didn't do any of that for publicity. He did that
correct.
Because he wanted to support, and he saw in you, you know, something special and new and different and something that he wanted to learn about, which I think
yeah.
is just awesome.
And I was supposed to do a sound check, and I was just like, he just wanted to talk. He was talking to me. I'm like, I'm just going to talk to him. I'm going to do the sound
course.
Check right now. So we talked for like, you know, a good 10 minutes or so before the show, and he was very just intrigued by all of it. And yeah, Yeah. I don't know much about any of that controversy, but I'm a huge fan.
I don't either, but I wanted to make a point to be like, he's on the good side, you guys. So, yeah.
You've seen that sketch he did years ago, the blind KKK member.
Yes.
That is brilliant.
It's genius. It's so I know. That's the it's
He really is a genius.
The greatest.
Anyway, so that's my revelation. I got it off my chest.
Dad's a clown.
My dad's a clown.
Fantastic.
And so is Rod's. I love it.
And now I'm a clown, and I've grown up to be a clown.
James.
Well, I'm going to keep in the show business theater theme.
I love it.
Oh, so that's the thing you said earlier. Like, yeah, my family's not from show business. You guys either. I'm like, well, so
kind of.
A birthday party is considered
glad
show business.
I'm you saved that. It was worth the wait for that reveal.
Yes, completely.
So as I said earlier, early to mid 80s, I've gone to community college for a couple of years. I've taken some acting classes. I'm still living at home. I'm essentially a slacker. And I get a job in an office. At one point, I worked for Equifax, of all places.
You did?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
And if I was still there, this never would have happened.
Okay, good.
But I lived in New Jersey, and I used to take the bus into New York and go to see plays constantly. This is before I turned pro.
Uh-huh.
But I was drawn to it. Mm. But I was working like a day job and doing amateur theater in New Jersey and going to see plays. So this is like early to mid 80s. Mm-hmm. I'd go to Broadway plays and I loved it. I would see musicals. I would see straight plays. I would see all kinds of stuff. And then I decided, well, there are a couple things. One is you're familiar with second acting.
Second acting?
Second acting.
When you show up.
It's intermission. You go to the theater at intermission. You casually pick up a program. There's usually a stack of programs outside, or you just kind of wander into the lobby. And you look like you belong, and you find a seat.
Uh-huh.
So I would do that. I used to get standing room for plays. There was a Rosemary Harris production of Noel Coward's Hay Fever in 85.
Okay.
I saw it 5 times.
Wow.
I was obsessed with it.
Just the second act or the whole thing? No, the whole thing. Okay, go ahead.
Back then, you could get standing room for like $10 or $20. I would stand in the back. And then now and then, after intermission, someone would leave.
Sure.
And there'd be seats in the orchestra section. I would go down there. Occasionally you'd be caught by an usher and you go, oh no, I'm just back here.
Uh-huh.
I was just obsessed with this play because it was just something I wanted to do. And here were these people in this really funny play on stage doing wonderful acting.
Mm-hmm.
And it I was sort of unhappy. I hadn't quite pushed myself to go to New York yet. I remember like getting off work one day. This is a sidebar to the story, but it gives you a sense of my mood. At like around 5:30, and I went, you know, if I actually caught the bus now, I could get to New York by 7 and I could see Hay Fever again.
Wow.
And I went back. And years, Campbell Scott was in that production. And years later, I met him and I said, hi, I want to tell you something. In 1985, this is like 20 years later, I went to see that production of Hay Fever 5 times and he took a beat and went, why? It may not have been the most important production in the world. Yeah, but
it represented something really special to me.
And I can read the play now and remember every actor's line readings and every bit of business. Anyway, so I used to slip down to the orchestra section. So then I started getting a little more cocky. And I thought, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to make my way backstage.
Mm.
I was like, so how can I do this? So I developed a technique, which was go to the stage door, open the program, look at a non-famous actor, it's the person who played the maid, ask for them, and they would let you back in.
Wow.
And then you go to Rosemary Harris's dressing room.
Yes, yes.
I did this with Hay Fever. Rosemary Harris offered me a drink. Other people were coming around. Once you're backstage, you belong there.
Sure, of course. Right. Well, they're not going to be like, also, like, they've just done a show. They're like, oh, hey, how are you? They're like, they're not thinking you're back, you know.
And true, I wasn't the suave figure you see before you now. I was a sort of skinnier, goofy kid from New Jersey without a sense of style yet.
I love it.
Once you were back there, they assumed you were someone's friend.
Of course.
That's such an interesting technique.
Yes. So I saw.
I don't think you can do that anymore. No,
this is very pre-9/11 behavior.
Yes, yes, yes. Yes, they're now. It's a big deal now, especially.
I had a friend named Nick, and we took acting classes together. We went to see Long Day's Journey into Night.
Oh, wow.
With Jack Lemmon and Kevin Spacey.
Whoa.
As Edmund.
Jamie?
As Edmund. No, as Jamie. I think you're right. Yeah. And that was like in the late 80s or something.
Okay.
And we did the same thing. We went back. There's actually a maid in that show.
Yes.
And we asked for the maid's name. I still remember her name. Her name was Mary Lynn McClintock. I don't know if she's still acting. And I went back, and as we went back, I heard someone say, "Who are they?" Because we're these two Jersey goofballs.
Right.
They could just tell that we were Jersey goofballs. And I remember the person at the stage, they were going, "Friends of Mary Lynn's." We go backstage, and then my friend, we start looking for Jack Lemmon's dressing room. It's a big theater. And some woman walks by, and my friend, who's very good in these situations, says with faux exasperation, "Where is Jack's dressing room?" And she directed us to his dressing room.
Wow.
And we walk in. It's a large room. And he sees us, and he has a big smile on his face and says, with total friendliness and sweetness, "Hey, fellas."
Oh.
And we were like, "Oh, you're so great." "Oh, thank you very much." It was so sweet. So, Drew, then I started getting cockier, and I thought, I got a shortcut. I've got a fail-safe. I've got a shortcut. Instead of going to the stage door, I've done college. I know what a theater is like. I just had to find the right moment, and as the people were leaving, curtain call, people are leaving, I would go to the foot of the stage, do a quick look around, hop on the stage, and go off into the... Now, I'm not proud of this.
Oh, my God.
How do you get away with that?
Pre-9/11.
A little skinny.
Oh, yeah.
Just find your moment when they're not looking. Hop up. Once you're back, you're good. Kids, don't do this at home. Don't do this in the theater.
They can't. I mean, you know,
no,
you can't
do this in the theater. I would wander around. I remember meeting people then. There was a John Guare's House of Blue Leaves.
Sure.
I remember speaking to a young Ben Stiller backstage.
Oh, right.
He was famous when he played the teenage son in that. Just, I would do things like this.
Swizzy Kurtz
was in it, and in fact, I believe I met her too, yes.
Yeah. Wow.
So I love doing this. This is my thing. So here's the capper to the story. I'm with my friend Nick, who I used to do this with. Sometimes I do it alone. Sometimes I do it with him. We're in New York. We haven't seen a play. We're just hanging out in Manhattan. We're in Midtown. It's around 11 o'clock. At the time, Judd Hirsch was in a play called I'm Not Rappaport.
Okay.
Written
yes,
by Murray Siskel.
Okay. Yes.
He was in the Cleavon Little was also in
Oh, wow. From Blazing
Star
Saddles.
Star of Blazing Saddles.
Yeah.
They played old men in the play. Now, I would later actually see the play, but we didn't see it this night. We just went, hey, let's go backstage and meet Judd Hirsch, star of Taxi.
Yeah,
so we pick up a program. We look in the play. It says Policeman Fred Wellington. We go to the door and go, Fred Wellington, please. They go right this way. We walk in.
Oh, my gosh.
It was a smaller theater. There's a spiral staircase that leads to the dressing rooms.
Mm-hmm.
We go up. Mercedes Rule is in the play.
Oh, sure.
She, and I actually knew someone who knew her. I knew an actor in New Jersey who knew her. So I had a little in there. But I'm like, hey, how's it going? I know Ward, you know, blah, blah. She's pleasant. We continue to go up the stairs because the goal is to meet Mr. Hirsch.
Yes.
It's a small dressing room. The door is open. He's probably my age at the time, which means he's like in his 50s, but he's playing an old man and his shirt is off. He's sitting there. He's got a large, hairy chest and he's using spirit gum or something to take off his old man makeup. He's peeling stuff off. And me and Nick, in our stonewashed 80s jeans and bad haircuts, appear at the door. Judd Hirsch turns his head, sees these two kids standing there, and my hand to God says, where'd you guys come from? The street?
Oh.
And I said, yeah, we did, as a matter of fact. Thinking that's a great cover. It's true, but it sounds like I'm making a joke.
Right.
Right.
And then he kind of looks back in the mirror, and there's just an awkward pause. There's no Jack, quite understandably. Oh, I'm 100% on Judd Hirsch's side here.
Yes.
He's taking his makeup off by himself.
Yes.
These two kids just stand there, and there's an awkward pause, and we say something like, yeah, you're really great. And then there's another beat, and Judd Hirsch turns to us and goes, well, good night, right?
Oh, yes.
And we slink down the stairs. And
got what you needed.
I'm not sure if that was the last time, but it should have been the last time. And it probably was the last time.
Because you felt like, oh, we're
done.
Yeah, we
and
encroached.
There's a little addendum to the story. So time goes on. I get older. I move to New York. I become an actor. And then I move to L.A. And my first gig in LA is Numbers, the procedural starring Judd Hirsch.
Oh, wow, right.
Now, my scenes are not actually with Judd Hirsch, so I don't meet him on the set, but I become friendly with the producer, and we're chatting, and I tell the producer this story. And then the producer and I actually stayed in touch with each other a little after I wrapped the show, and he wrote to me one day and said, James, I told Judd Hirsch that story from the 80s, and he remembered it.
Wow.
And he said he was really tickled that you're an actor now. And I love that he remembered this non-event.
Right.
One night, a couple kids stood by the door. But there was something weird about it that he remembered.
Right.
I
and maybe in the moment he was like, are they going to jump me? You know,
trust me,
if you saw us back then,
you wouldn't have thought. You know, but I understand that, like, it's like when you're back, it's such a sacred space and you're backstage and, you know, when we're down in the, you know, at the casita and it's like, I'll, you know, change in front of anybody and we're like sweaty and I'll be like, you know, naked and a wig and makeup running everywhere. And you're just, that's just what you do. It's part of the job. But Annie, I am so awful to people who come backstage without, like, when we're getting changed.
Right.
There's no space. It's our room. It's like, I will come up and talk to you afterwards, but it's so invasive to come back. And when somebody's, you know, when they haven't been invited back, you know, to do that, because you're like, that is totally not what you're supposed to do.
Team Hirsch.
Yeah. Yes. And I love that. Like, in that moment, you're like, oh, maybe we shouldn't.
Yeah.
No,
we got a little too close to the sun.
And I, you know, I just think as a, you know, and also as a kid, you know, you have these things, you know, you want to be so close to all of it, and it's magical, and it's like a fun thing to do, and it's like, it's also this secretive thing. You're like, we can go and do this, and we can get really close to these stars, and you haven't really considered, like, oh, these are people who, you know, what if everyone was doing this to them all the time?
Yeah.
You know, we haven't really earned the right to you know, do this, and it's like, and it's also, there's something, we're lying by being back, you know, by being in their space. And
did, like, the actors that played the, like, the maid or the cop, did anything ever come up with them being like, I don't know that person?
No, I don't. Well, I don't. Yeah, I don't know. That's a good. Next day. How was your friend? What friend?
We would
ignore them.
You would
it
just
was a
go
ghost.
Bypass
it's an
them.
Old theater.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Mary Lynn.
But yeah.
I played the maid in Long Day's Journey in 87.
Oh, it's awful when we, you know, I know. And just, I have such regrets.
My favorite people, by the way, the supporting players.
Oh, absolutely.
But go on, yes.
I know, and I love when I especially when you go and see something, and you're like, who is that? I want to follow this person. And, you know, when I saw Hamilton on Broadway, the girl who was who played the bartender, she had this big mohawk, and she's gorgeous, and I could not take my eyes off of her.
Yes.
And I was seeing Hamilton for the first time, which was a life-changing experience. And this was before I had heard any of the music. I didn't know anything about it. I saw it the week it opened in New York, and I was just so blown away by it. But I still I'll always remember that woman. And I love those. But I think about it there's a play called Ruthless, which is a musical about a little girl who, it's based on The Bad Seed and Valley of the Dolls and All About Eve.
Yeah.
And it's very campy. It's hilarious. And one day I want to play Sylvia St. Croix so badly because it's all women characters, but there's the grandmother, agent character is always played by a man in drag. But it's about a little girl.
I didn't know about this. That sounds amazing.
It's great. It's so fun. And it's about a little girl who doesn't get the lead in her school play. So she kills the little girl and gets the lead.
Sure.
And her grandmother is her agent and, like, has her climbing the ranks of elementary school theater.
Oh my
and
gosh.
Her mother is like a housewife, and it's very 50s, and she just wants to be a housewife. But then her mother gets the stage bug and then screws her own daughter over. And so the second act is very 60s, and her mother's a huge Broadway star, and the daughter has gone away to reform school. So the daughter comes back, and the daughter is like 8 or 9, as she's supposed to be. And the mother is a hard, so everyone's a terrible person, and everyone's trying to screw each other over, and it's like family, and it's wonderful. And I was obsessed with it. And in freshman year of college, in the Samuel French, you know, not the program, the script, it says, if you have any questions about this production, if you, you know, you want to mount the play, here's my address. And it's Joel Paley who wrote the play. Here's my address. Write to me. I wrote him this gushing fan letter that was just like, this is the best thing I've ever read. And I remember saying, like, you're like John Waters meets Christopher Durang. And those are that's when you're, you know, a gay freshman in college, that you're referencing. And two of my, to this day, two of my favorites. And
or a culturally gay straight kid, because I was so into drag.
Oh, did you know?
John Waters,
I'm
too.
Sure you were. Yeah, exactly. And I got a letter back from him 6 months later. A giant package in the mail came, and he said, "Your letter touched us so much. I happened to get it the night of a benefit show where with Bernadette Peters, where she played the mom, and we did this out in L.A. And he goes, I read your letter to the whole cast.
Wow.
Here's an autographed script from the whole cast. Here's a picture of me and Bernadette. It was just a picture that they had taken for me.
How
at the
old
cast
were you
party.
When you got this?
I was 19.
Amazing.
And it was basically just like, thank you. It just really meant a lot. What you had written. And I was just like through the moon, and I should have stopped then. But I went a step further and wrote him another letter and thanked him so much. And then said, if you have any jobs available, I'm an actor and a writer and I'd love to work with you. And I did that thing that's like that you just don't do. And I just didn't know better. And to this day, I would love to meet him and tell him, like, you changed my life in that moment. And I ruined it by saying, hire me and put me on
and
something.
And you did not hear back after
of
that.
Of course not. I never heard anything back from him. And
you're a
baddie.
Like, you went to Judd Hirsch's dressing room.
Yes, and that's what I'm saying.
Far.
Like I pulled
at
a Baniac and Nick. Is that his name?
Yes, old Nick.
And yeah. And so anyway, So it's you do those things, and you're just like, God, I just really shat that bed, and I should have just been like, this is let this be what this is, and it was just a magical moment because I really. And the first time it was truly, I just wanted to tell him what a fan I was of his work. And then it was this moment of like, I this is my opportunity. Like, I guess I know Bernadette Peters now. And I guess this is my time to jump on this. And they're going to hire me. They're going to go, you're an actor? Come with us, kid. Join the circus.
After the second letter, whenever the phone rang, he was afraid it was you saying, I'm outside.
Yeah, I know. Exactly. I know. It's like the thing where you're like, you have to be careful with the people because you don't know, who's out on your ledge.
But that is a great gesture that he did, and
it was so lovely.
You still carry that with
thing.
You today. I'm not proud of sneaking backstage, but I still carry like my evening where Rosemary Harris offered me alcohol.
Absolutely,
sure. Talk to me about acting.
Well, and also you can look back and go, yeah, that wasn't right. But you were coming from such a genuine place.
I was. It was.
It
benign.
Wasn't like there was anything, And now the reason why people can't. Do that so much, obviously with security reasons, but you have people on Broadway who are not necessarily, that might be more movie stars than people want to just flood them for different reasons. Yeah. It's not because I want to, be in your, I want to breathe the same air and have a drink with you and be with a great actor for the night, for 10 minutes or whatever. It's a different sort of thing. And, but
it's often like, can we just get a selfie, please? I really want the
right,
followers.
Exactly. And it's just exhausting. Ugh. But it's nice that, when you are coming from, when someone does those kind of things, because he could have easily read my letter and thrown it and been like, that's sweet and thrown it away. But
do you still have that stuff?
Oh, of course I do.
Oh, that's so cool.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
When I was a little kid, like, 8 or something, I wrote to Beverly Cleary.
Oh, yes, I did too.
And she wrote me back. Did she write me back?
She didn't write me back. Wow.
I'm sure she did this regularly, but probably couldn't get to everybody.
Yeah.
She wrote me on personal stationery and referenced things I'd written on my letter. It was a handwritten response.
Wow.
It was incredible.
Yeah. I did that to Robin Williams as a kid, and he wrote me personalized autograph. I mean, who knows if it was him or not, but it was so big to me.
Yeah, no, sure.
Oh, of course.
I'm sure Robin Williams did, because I seemed like that was his greatest, thing and downfall. Like, just, leading to just please everyone.
I still have it on my wall.
And a kid, there's a thing about a kid writing you, they're just like, oh, it means so much,
Yeah.
Beverly Cleary did not write me back, but Peggy Parrish did, who wrote the Amelia Bedelia series.
Ah, yes.
Which is one of the most maddeningly upsetting, mentally ill characters in children's literature. But she wrote me back, I remember. But maybe Beverly Cleary was just too busy that day. I don't know. I don't blame her. Still love her.
It was a great moment. So.
Yes. Yeah. All right. Well, we are way out of time, and I love you both so much for doing this, and I love
Thanks
this talk.
Thanks for having us.
This was deep nerd actor talk, and
I
love it.
This topic
it's awesome.
A for me.
Oh, I know. I love it. Fantastic. I want to thank James Urbaniak and Roz Dresvillez for being on this episode of Minor Revelations. You guys, have a week.